Push-ups on the other side of the wall. The reps are 10, he goes 10, 1, 10, 2, 10, 3. Then he falls. Then I hear mother shouting from down the hall. She said, boys, it's getting late. She says, boys, it's getting late.
Thank you. And finishes up today's program with the great song Dalliance has performed live at WFMU's March 17th live show from Austin, Texas at Beerland. Wedding Present with Dalliance. Donovan Quinn before that from Honky Tonk Medusa did Night Shift. Illich from Un Jour Content d'Ot 1970s recordings from Illich. Helena Rodriguez, name of the track we heard. The Brief Encounter before that, self-titled CD. Visions, the song we heard. Mors Ontologica from the Used Kids session. We heard Don't Feel All Right. We opened that set with a great compilation called Eastern Bloc Funk Experience. A band called Cherwon Gitari. A song called Coda. And that's it. I'll see you next week with my 6.5-year-old daughter, Lila, programming the hits. If we're lucky, maybe there'll be a Kleenex sing-along or something like that. If we're very lucky. Be nice, will you? Okay, see you next week. Stay tuned. Too Much Information's next. My name's Scott. It's WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I'm Paula McCartney, and we are looking at a photograph that I made in Interlochen, Michigan in November of 2006. This image is Blue Jay, and the Blue Jay is perching on one of many branches of a bare tree in winter alongside a lake.
I like how he's kind of looking back over his shoulder at us.
The bird is glancing back at us. It seems like the bird is watching us as much as we are watching this Blue Jay. Here is a second image. This is American Goldfinches, which is hanging in the Klomp Ching Gallery in Dumbo in Brooklyn, New York, where the exhibition Birdwatching is on view right now. These American Goldfinches were made in Minneapolis in April of 2008.
Are all American Goldfinches usually this bright yellow?
American Goldfinches are usually this bright yellow. It's kind of interesting that they're this bright yellow at the beginnings of spring. Here's another image, the spotted back thrush, which was photographed in St. Croix Falls of Wisconsin in October of 2008, perching very jauntily on a curved branch.
Is the spotted back thrush common to this area?
He is not, and the reason is because I made this bird up. There is no bird called the spotted back thrush, but my bird here does have a spotted back, as you can see, and he is about the size and shape of a thrush, and so that's why he was named the spotted back thrush.
One day, photographer Paula McCartney needed some paintbrushes, and so she went to Michael's, the craft store. Michael's is one of those places that has everything, so it wasn't really surprising to Paula when she found herself in an aisle filled with fake stuff.
Fake foliage, the fake leaves, fake grapes, where they have the wreaths that your grandma buys to make the fall and Christmas wreaths. And I was looking at the fake birds there, and it kind of hit me that, oh, I could buy these fake birds and put them into my own photographs to create these idealized landscapes that I'd always wanted to make. Ever since I was a teenager, I would go on hikes, and during those times, I was always interested in looking at the birds that I would hear, but quite often you can't get a good view of it because you get your snapshot camera out just to take a snapshot of it, and by the time you've done that, the bird is gone. So I decided that I would just make these photographs where the bird was not moving and just waited for me to take its portrait. So that's kind of what led to buying the birds that are already manufactured and putting them exactly where I wanted them in the landscape.
For years, Paula would hike into the woods with her camera and a Tupperware dish containing one or two of these brightly colored styrofoam songbirds. Her project has culminated with a book called Birdwatching, and all the photos in it have this dreamlike perfection to them, but you need to look at them closely.
I don't want it to be a trick. I begin the book with this quote that I read in a biography by John James Audubon, one of the great collectors and documenter of birds, that says, "You have now before you representations of some of the most richly colored of our birds, and one whose history is some degree peculiar." And I loved that when I found out that this is perfect, a perfect beginning to this book, because peculiar greatly describes how my birds are, because they, while they're real craft store birds, they are not real live birds. And so that's the first hint that the viewer gets, that there's something up, there's something peculiar about this. They should seem a little too perfect. No blur, no motion. There's basically sitting still to have their portrait made. One time I did show the book to a birder, and he looked through the book page by page and never got that they were fake. I think he was very proud because he would look at the labels that they identified the bird. He's like, "I've seen that bird, and I've seen this bird, and I've seen that bird." And by the end, I was just flabbergasted. I didn't know, like, should I tell him that, you know, they're not real birds, that they're fake birds? Because I didn't want to make him feel bad. But when I did tell him, he was very upset because I think he felt really tricked and fooled. I kind of had decided that he didn't really look very closely. He was looking through my book, assuming it was real, but not really looking at the images, but just confirming that he, too, had seen all these birds, that he was, in fact, a good birder because he also had been able to identify and find these birds. The images end up being a combination of real and fake. These are real landscapes. The birds are really attached to the trees, but they also aren't real birds. And so I think they do bring to light the fact that, you know, what you see in photographs is true and cannot be true. So the ideal viewer of these images would be someone who is aware that everything isn't fake, but can really take the time to look to see that while the birds are not alive, that they are actual birds sitting in the landscape. I have the ability to change things, but I'm changing things in reality. I'm not changing things after the fact.
It seems to me that there has to be a new category. There's not just real and fake, there's real fake.
I think that's a great description of these photographs. They are real fake. And it also brings to, like, why isn't it not all real, right? Because those are real birds that are sitting there. They're, you know, what is a bird? Like, is a bird the alive thing, or is a bird, you know, the symbol and the imagery of a bird? Kind of questions, like, what is the reality?
You can see Paula McCartney's photos on display at the Klomching Gallery in Dumbo through April 23rd, and her book, Birdwatching, has just been published by Princeton Architectural Press. Fred Richin is a professor of photography at NYU, and he's also got a new book. It's called After Photography. It's about the future of digital imaging and how it's changing the way we live and think. But when I spoke with him at his office downtown, I learned that Fred is no stranger to the future.
I wrote a piece in 84 for the New York Times Magazine on the digital future of photography as well as film. And what concerned me then was, would photography in the future be credible? If they could be so easily manipulated and seamlessly manipulated, would anybody believe anything about what's going on in the world beyond the local neighborhood in which they live?
This piece angered his editor so much, he actually had to stop writing for the magazine. He was told it was unfair to bother the reader with anything more than 6 months in the future. But in 1996, Fred Richin returned to the New York Times to work on the new website. Collaborating with French photographer Jules Perez, Fred Richin produced one of the first multimedia pieces of journalism.
We had all kinds of maps, chronologies, histories, terminologies, vocabularies accompanying with it. But the basic idea was that you could get lost in the journey in Bosnia trying to figure out what was going on. For us, the photography became a series of questions, much more than a series of answers. And it was something that was set up for readers to become confused, for readers to understand that it's a much more difficult set of issues than simply, you know, Muslim versus Serb, Croat kinds of thing. It was a much deeper and more complex set of issues. We wanted to implicate the readers in trying to figure out, in fact, what was going on. And in that sense, I think it was highly successful. I naively thought that this was the beginning of the revolution. I naively thought in 96, when we did this, they nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, you know, that because they nominated it, they acknowledged that this was an important, you know, kind of first step. I thought it was primitive in many ways, but it was a first step. And I am personally shocked that 14 years later, there have been so little attempts to use the nonlinear narrative, the hypertext, the hypermedia, to explore the world, given that that's what the web is good at. But instead, we're actually going backwards in terms of media.
Even though the mainstream media would rather churn out online slideshows and web polls than the kind of work Richin almost pioneered in 1996, we have, in a way, caught up with Fred Richin. Because today, we are confronted with so many manipulated photographs, it's almost impossible to take any image at face value. But for Fred Richin, this is both a moment of grave necessity and a moment of great opportunity.
A lot of people are skeptical of photography right now. They don't believe the authenticity of it automatically. If you looked at a picture from the Vietnam War of a girl being hit by napalm, you knew that girl was being hit by napalm. You knew that that girl was suffering. You knew there was something wrong about that. If you see a similar picture today, you say, oh, is that from that side or this side? Who's pushing it? Is it propaganda? Did they change it? Who's publishing it? What do they want to get out of us? What do they want from us? And the girl who's suffering somehow is secondary or tertiary in the discussion. Somehow we don't even care about her. She's not. She's just a kind of a reference point, a signifier. She's not real. She's not there. And what happens finally to us as people is it dehumanizes us, because the suffering of the person is less important than the image. The person in the image hardly exists anymore. To me, that's the one of the fantastically unobserved moral failings and political failings of contemporary time, that we don't recognize that change. We don't recognize what's happened. Everything's a reality show.
It seems, though, that you are suggesting that a true digital future can solve some of these issues.
Right.
Can you explain how you see that working?
Well, in many, many ways. I mean, if you have 100 people with cell phones outside, if something happens, you'll get 100 versions. It becomes cubist of the same subject. So by being cubist and having those 100 different perspectives, it's very hard to refute it. There is a real girl being napalmed because 100 people are saying it in 100 different ways. The authority of the one has eroded. The Time magazine photographer, it's eroded. It's finished. But it's the 100 people with the cell phones on YouTube or wherever it would be. You know, when the baby falls off the table on YouTube, we believe the baby fell off the table because some amateur did it. It wasn't a professional, kind of slick, sophisticated, manipulating kind of a
media image. Event. It was not a baby falling off the table media event.
It was not a photo opportunity in the same sense. So I think there are many, many, many strategies. You know, like I've argued in the book, for example, that involving everybody who has something to say, that's a much more interesting way of doing journalism, a way of doing media in generally, to try to help us all figure out who we are, what we are, where we are. It's not just the individual creator, author, star, branded, hyped, and so on, but it's us intelligent people together, feeling people together, trying to figure it out. You know, we're smart enough to do that, but you need a political will to do that. You need to resist to do that. You need to feel that the world is more important than the media. And once you start to understand that and do that, these things are very, very easy to fight back. And the digital makes it all possible because you can basically footnote a photograph. You can say, okay, I was there. I'm the guy on the right. Click on me. I'll tell you what was really going on. There's all kinds of ways that you can do. We're so upset about Photoshop. But on the other hand, if scientists, in terms of global warming, say that in 50 years this is what it's going to look at like, we can make pictures of it, photograph it so it doesn't happen. I mean, the point to me is not to photograph after the apocalypse. The point to me is to prevent the apocalypse.
It seems that you're suggesting that digital photography, far from giving us a less true picture of the world, actually has the opportunity to give us a true understanding of the world.
Well, a truer understanding of the world. I think, you know, analog is really continuous tone. That's what analog means. And the discrete segments of the digital, the fact that you can jump around, is a different worldview. Within a Newtonian worldview, the famed Cartier-Bresson photograph of a man jumping a puddle leaves the reader confident that he will land on the other side. In a subatomic quantum universe, it remains a matter of probabilities. You can jump around the quantum leap. The digital allows all these multiple perspectives. It's multiple, multiple ways of looking at it. And that's what we mean by multiculturalism. That's what I hope we mean by multimedia. It's multi-perspectives. So you could play with history, you could play with time, you could play with the future, you know, again, in very much like a quantum physics, where you can live time forwards and backwards, you can die before you're born, you know, like Borges, you can, in fiction, you could play with these ideas, because that's how we dream, that's how we are, and this kind of material, practical, concrete, one after the other kind of thinking is really limits us tremendously. And this digital opens us up. You know, that there's an impact already of these new ways of thinking, but we're just not at the point yet to have a kind of a conscious, deliberate conversation about it, because it has to kind of emerge and come up in us and then figure it out. And then one day we're going to say, my God, where did this come from? And then we'll look back and say, for decades and decades, we've been experimenting with this, playing with this, being changed by this. We think of ourselves one way. The media itself has to be an extension of that and push us into new ways of thinking about things and about who we are. We know more and more that we are code-based. Animals are code-based and so on. And so I think one of the things that the digital media is opening up to us is to understand ourselves differently instead of the outside appearance at a level of code. And so at a level of code, you know, all us and animals and so on and so forth are going to have tremendous similarities that we're used to thinking of as differences. And I think that the fun of that is to reimagine ourselves. And the fun of that is to reimagine ourselves to the point where we don't see the other as the other, you know, that we don't understand, we're afraid of, we want to kill them, we want to have wars with them, we enslave them, we eat them, but to see them as part of us, and us as part of them. I don't think it's an accident that we came up with a code-based medium at the time that we came up with DNA. That's one of the extraordinary excitements about digital media. In terms of photography, photography means writing with light. There's all kinds of light. Light now, you know, used to be at a certain speed. Light slowed down. We could slow it down. We could play with the light. It's not the same sort of thing anymore. Writing itself is subjective. Writing itself means it's your personal impressions, your opinions, your perspective. It's not this objective reality that we thought of photography as being. I think that's healthy, that we see it as subjective, as interpretive, as not objective. It goes back to the root of the word. This is where the revolution starts. The revolution hasn't, for the most part, started. The revolution so far is repurposing, efficiency, simulation, but it's not really begun. And what I anticipate, you know, with delight, is for the revolution to actually get going, and we reimagine, rethink ourselves and the world using these extraordinary new media that are just waiting for us to take advantage of, to use, and to help us figure out who we are and where we're going.
Robert Voigt is a German photographer who's been taking pictures of trees for the last 7 years.
They look like real trees. They're made out of plastic. They're made out of metal. Some are made out of wood connected with other materials. Basically, all those trees are hiding something. They're hiding those antenna structures. They're cellular phone masts. And, well, that's basically what I'm doing. I'm trying to sneak them out in the nature and follow them and to put them into the right light, and then I'll photograph them.
Voigt has traveled all over the world to photograph these cell phone antennas disguised as trees. But for him, they're not really fake trees.
Well, that's maybe a little bit because I have a special relationship after 7 years to those trees.
Okay, how about real fake?
Yeah, they're real fake. They're definitely real fake.
Voigt's pictures make up a really strange arboretum. There is an amazing variety of species, and some that are truly, surely one of a kind.
If you compare the trees I found in South Korea, for example, they're metal structures with a little bit of paint around it and some leaves in sort of a really strange way connected to the structure. The English people, they do wonderful trees with shapes that are all natural and so on. So,
in America, you've got some pretty grandiose ones, like the cactus I'm thinking about.
Yeah, the cactus I found in the States, that's, I think, the most unique tree I found. This is so extremely well-built, and it's so beautiful. I think this is really the best tree I ever found somehow.
These things are built to hide cell phone towers. So how did you, as an artist and a photographer, locate these trees?
In the beginning, I had almost no chance to find those trees because, I mean, they're just built to hide. So, first of all, I had to contact many parish councils in England or activist groups or everything I could find in the net just to bring me the first 15, 20 trees to get on my way to travel. In the end, I had really the companies work together with me and telling me the GPS coordinates and showing me the best places I can use for my pictures. There are activist groups that are 100% against hiding those structures. And for example, in Holland, I was following a tree for some years on the net. We could find many... how do you say that? Activists went there and cut down the surrounding woods and tried to set the thing on fire and so on. Not everybody loves those trees, but the funny thing is the longer one of those structures is around, the people start to overlook it. You know, that's what I found mostly. I had one guy that was actually one of those cacti. He told me, I was asking him how he likes this cactus around, and he said, yeah, that cactus. Oh, yeah, right, that's an mobile phone antenna. You think it's dangerous? So he forgot everything, you know, by the time he was living there already 5 years right beside that cactus, and he was not any more interested. For me, I learned also that a cactus is a tree, by the way. I didn't know that before.
I'm curious about why you use that title, New Trees.
Well, I mean, they're the old trees, that's the time before, the trees that are all natural, that we know for hundreds and hundreds of years, that made us people, our human mankind, to what we are. I mean, just think about the first connection we had to trees. We had firewood, we built the first wheel out of it, we did so much with a tree. Even, you know, in the Bible, you find plenty of places where the tree plays a big role. So that was the old tree, you know, and the new trees we built ourselves. That's basically what I wanted to say. It's a new era, and, well, it's fresh, it's new, and it's the future.
So, Robert, the big question for me then is, what do you feel these new trees say about our relationship with technology?
Yeah, well, I think we're one step ahead, huh?
So you think it's more like a race with nature, and we're winning?
Sure, sure. It's the human mimicry doing everything to connect somehow to nature, but also leaving it far behind. So you never know when you go through a forest the next time. Maybe you're surrounded by fake trees all over.
Seidel will be publishing Robert Voigt's New Trees sometime in 2010. The writer Luc Sant has logged hours and hours and hours looking at old photo postcards.
I once said, and I'm not sure, I think I can stand behind the statement, that I've seen virtually every possible human activity represented in these cards except childbirth.
Sant's most recent book is called Folk Photography. It contains about 150 images from his personal Real Photo postcard collection. And while there are no depictions of childbirth, there are images of rough-and-ready brass bands, riverside baptisms, a tar and feathering, and cows, chickens, and hogs in domestic-like settings. Lots of things you've probably never seen before, including numerous depictions of disasters.
I was first drawn to disaster cards. I didn't know there was such a form, you know, postcards of disasters, fires, floods, train wrecks, you know, dramatic pictures.
So can you explain why these images, you call them real photo postcards? Why are they not just photo postcards or fake photo postcards? Why real photo postcards?
It comes from the fact that, you know, most postcards you see going back, I'd say 90 to 95% of postcards going all the way back to the beginnings of the form are based on photographs, you know, including the ones that are, you know, obviously colored and the ones that kind of maybe sort of look like drawings, but they are based on photos but have been very retouched. These are called real photo postcards because, unlike the others which were printed on photo litho presses, these were actually printed in the darkroom. These are, for the most part, contact prints made directly on postcard stock.
Now, you write in the introduction that you can derive enormous volumes of data from a single photo postcard, but the phenomenon of the photo postcard itself can only be grasped by looking at tens and thousands and hundreds of thousands of these images, what it seems you've done. Can you talk about what this phenomenon is and how it started to manifest itself to you?
Well, I the first real photo postcards of this sort that I ever saw, I bought from a street peddler on Astor Place in about 1980. Astor Place was this massive kind of flea market at the time. And this guy was standing there, his hands in his pockets, in front of Cooper Union, little pile of postcards at his feet. And I was walking by, and I see this picture of, like, Mexican bandits. And I stooped down and looked, and he had, I don't know, 30 or 40 of these cards, which were obviously the Mexican Revolution. I was kind of astounded by these. I'd never seen such a thing, that these were like public, you know, historical events, actual photographs. And you could tell they were tangibly, they were different from, you know, mere printed postcards. These were photographs. The following day, as chance would have it, I walked into an antique, you know, really a junk shop on Greenwich Avenue, and they had a postcard rack. And there were a couple more pictures which also had to do with the Mexican Revolution, also real photo postcards. And then not long after that, I went to the country and went to antique shops and started finding hundreds of them. When I got the bug, I started going everywhere I could to see more, including going to postcard shows, which are held twice a year in New York City and many other places in the country, and looking at just massive amounts of images and trying to find, you know, trying to define the borders of the phenomenon.
You know, these images were actually all the rage at a particular moment. It's almost like the next big thing. Was this like the Twitter of the early 20th century? Like, when were these things and why were they so popular?
Well, it's the coincidence of a whole bunch of phenomena all happening at once. One of them is that in 1900, I believe, or 1901, Kodak started issuing a line of small, cheap, light cameras that had very, very good technical properties and were available to pretty much the average person, the average, say, middle class, maybe lower middle class person. And then there were changes in postal regulations. There was the inception of rural free delivery. And there was a postcard craze, which really lasted, it was a fad, so it lasted about as long as fads do, from about 1906 to about 1910. But, you know, you mentioned the Twitter of the time, and I mean, I think there's something to that. I mean, there is, it is this decentralized system of communication that really does make us think of modern-day technological equivalents.
Yeah. So let's talk about the photographers. You refer to them as tinkerers in the introduction, but how did their fellow townsfolk relate to them? Were they the official photographers, or were they competing with the official photographers? Who were these people?
By and large, they were the official photographers. Bear in mind that I'd say, you know, a good 90, 95% of these cars are from very small towns, usually isolated small towns. They're from towns where there is one photographer who may either be just the photographer who takes the baby pictures and the postmortem pictures and the graduation pictures, or in some cases, maybe the photographer is also the druggist the stationer or all those things at once. And they become, by and by, the official photographer of the town. It's the kind of thing to which, maybe a local growing up in the town sees an opportunity and jumps on and buys a camera, sets himself up as the photographer. Maybe it's they've apprenticed with the earlier generation's photographer, and the postcard sideline is something that comes up around this time. Or, I've read some trade journals of the time, and you can see, there'll be an ad for, photographer's business, great postcard sideline, available in, whatever, Crescent City, California, only $1,000, and this would include the actual physical location, the equipment, the chemicals, and the goodwill of the town. So it's an official position. It's a bit like, becoming the town doctor or something like that.
Oh, wow. Now, you have a great line to describe these. You call them naively matter-of-fact. And I'm kind of wondering about the question of authority. Like, did these pictures have a sort of like, this is how it is? When the townspeople would look at these, they'd be like, yes, finally. Like, this is reality. This is how our world is. Did these photos work like that?
Yeah, I believe they did. I mean, I believe it was a mirror and a confirmation of experience. I think that's what it is. I don't have a body of correspondence or diaries to draw upon for evidence to this fact. I can only draw upon the, by and large, rather small body of messages on the back that refer to the fronts. Because often when there's a message on the back, a lot of them don't have anything on the back because they were saved in albums or drawers or whatever. The messages on the back often, there'll be some like incredibly gruesome scene on the front, and on the back it's, how are you? And don't forget to send me a postcard back, because there's a lot of trading of postcards evident in these messages. But when they do refer to the front, there is this quality of, this card is bearing testimony on my behalf. This is, where I live, and you can see my house with the little X above it, or that's me on the edge of the crowd, this is exactly what it looked like, or this is what it looked like, except it was worse when you were standing in the middle of it. There's a bit of that. They do seem to speak for the consumers of the cards.
Now, also in your book, you suggest that this is an area of study that deserves a lot more attention, and not just because it's this, window into this whole fascinating world, but also you talk about the relationship between these kind of photos and other photographers. You point out that, Walker Evans, with all of his postcard collections, barely has a few of these. Like, what is the connection you see sort of between these kind of photos and, the field of photography in its time and sort of right after as well?
Well, they come out of a vernacular tradition in American photography, which wasn't huge at the time, but does have its most visible representation in the work of the Civil War photographers like Alexander Gardner and Timothy O'Sullivan, which you can also see in scattered work here and there in the late 19th century. One great photographer who became a postcard photographer late in life was a guy in Nebraska named Solomon Butcher, who in the 1880s went about documenting sod house dwellers in rural Nebraska. These are, people who lived in treeless areas and made their houses from dirt. And he had them pose family by family outside their houses with their possessions. That is, they'd haul out, the piano, the dining room table, the rocking chair they brought from, Maine or someplace, the silverware, the cow, the goat, and the marriageable daughters, and they'd all be spread out in front of their house. And that's, it's the most kind of direct American photography you can imagine. And quite distinct from this was artistic photography of the time, which was an international affair, really. It was a matter of American photographers who had close contacts in Europe, and they were very much concerned with promoting photography as an art form, as a distinct from a mere artisanship, mere technological gimmickry. So they tried to make photographs that look like, as much as possible, like lithographs or even paintings. So people like Alfred Stieglitz, the early Edward Steichen, members of the Photo Secession in New York City, and the trickle down from them was what you see in a lot of the photography magazines of the time, which was all about, you know, lighting effects and cunning angles and things like this. And most of these cards were taken with natural light. And as far as angles go, they were concerned with information. So they were taking pictures head on and trying to be as inclusive as possible. There's a radical disjunction between these kinds of pictures and the pictures taken by the artistic photographers. They had nothing to say to one another at the time.
But this body of work does seem to speak to the future of photography,
exactly.
Though. And how does that happen?
Well, that happens in part because the whole generation of photographers who came of age in the 1930s had seen these pictures when they were kids. So whether they were consciously echoing them or not, I don't know. You know, the interesting thing about Evans, Evans had a huge collection. He had thousands and thousands of cards, which were all in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And, you know, in these thousands of cards, there's maybe a couple of dozen, at most, real photo cards. I don't know why that is, except that they were very unfashionable for a long time. In fact, when I started collecting, I started going to shows and to shops and stuff like that. You could spend at that time like $20 on a rare, you know, Christmas card by some artist, but real photo cards were herded into like a barrel for a quarter apiece. Collectors were not very much interested in them for decades. And I think it's a hangover of this artistry thing. You know, this printed card was by a significant artist whose name appears at the lower right-hand corner. Therefore, it has a value. These cards were made by, you know, no names. There are many of them unsigned, or they're by people we've never heard of. So who cares? And that was the predominant point of view for a very long time.
You know, when you're describing these photos, it seems like you could almost be talking about a random set of images if we just went to Flickr right now. You know, there's a very, very much of the future in these photos, sort of like unknown. You don't know who's taking the image. They can be very, very artistic, as you talk about, but there's also a desire to convey information and sort of communicate, and I was there.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, another thing to bear in mind, too, is that both the makers and the subjects of these cards were not in the least self-conscious about the process. That is, they didn't regularly look at photographs. They had, you know, they had pictures at home. They had a picture of grandma and grandpa taken at the ends of their lives. They had, you know, the new baby picture. They had a few pictures around the house before the era of the real photo postcard, but they didn't have a kind of image culture. You know, if they were, you know, the town doctor or something who was educated and subscribed to magazines, maybe, you know, they'd get some magazine like Collier's or something, or Harper's or Scribner's that had, you know, small black and white photographs, but they're strictly informational. Everybody always remarks on the fact that the people in these pictures aren't smiling, and everybody seems to think that's weird, but they would have thought just the opposite, because the smile, when you think about it, is, well, it's something that people had to learn from advertising and from pictures of Hollywood stars, and that didn't start happening until the 20s or so, and really didn't take full grip of the American imagination until the 40s. But furthermore, the smile is a mask. You know, it's something you put on to make yourself worthy of being photographed. The people in these pictures thought nothing of being photographed, not only not smiling, but going about their daily business, and they would look in the direction of the lens for the, you know, minute or two that the process took. And that was that. They didn't feel the need to put on a show for the camera. This was reality.
Luc Sant's Folk Photography is published by Yeti Books, and it just won the 2010 ICP Infinity Award for writing. Luke's book makes four new additions to my photography book collection. Normally, I shy away from books like Fred Richin's After Photography, but like I said, it's a must-read for anyone interested in how media is changing the way we live and think. And if you've been paying attention, you know that's sort of the big theme for Too Much Information. But to tell you the truth, dear listener, the real reason I was so psyched about doing this particular episode of TMI on photography was for reasons a lot less complicated or lofty. You see, I thought I was finally going to get my chance to do something I've always wanted to do on the radio. Humiliate photography book collector Martin Parr. Martin Parr is one of my favorite photographers. He seems to get to do whatever he wants. He travels the globe chasing down both the ordinary and the extraordinary, and he has perhaps the most legendary photo book collection in the world. Fiden has recently published two volumes showcasing some of the books in Parr's collection, and these are must-haves for any serious photo book collector. But beware, they inspire both admiration and terrible, terrible jealousy. But, by way of the dark nets, I have acquired over the past few years a number of photography books that Martin Parr does not own. Books that I know for certain would blow his mind, which is what I wanted to do on the radio. But he did not respond to any of my emails. And not just the ones with the subject line like radio interview request or Dear Martin Parr. No, he's ignored them all. Even the one I sent out the other day in all caps. Last chance to prove your books are better than my books, dude. So, dear listener, I've brought a few of my photo books here to the studio, and I will share them instead with you. The crown jewel of my collection is a book called Cairo, Illinois. It's kind of like a precursor to Larry Clark's Tulsa, but here the aimless drug use, violence, and sexual depravity is not 1970s Oklahoma, but 1930s Illinois. And these photos, they were all taken by Walker Evans. In 1935, Walker Evans shot a porn book. And even though his name is not on the book, you can tell it's him. It's like Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, but with naked people and lots of alcohol and guns. And the pictures taken at night in the whorehouse, these are obviously shot with the same hidden camera that Evans uses a few years later, famously in the subways of New York City. I own a lot of photo books documenting the great American road trip. It's one of my favorite genres to collect, and over the years I've amassed a number of books done in the style of Robert Frank, Stephen Shore, and Joel Sternfeld. But the best one is a small volume of shots all taken around a truck stop in Amarillo, Texas. The photographer, Betsy Moss, must have been a waitress or related to the owners. The pictures start in the mid-1950s and go all the way to about 1975. They're mostly portraits, truckers, highway patrolmen, hitchhikers, but there are also a number of photographers who show up, steely-eyed young men with Leicas hanging around their necks, and they all stare into Moss's camera with a look that says, "America, here I come." I don't recognize most of the photographers in the pictures, but The young man in the muscle shirt near the end of the book is most definitely Stephen Shore. Now that digital cameras are so inexpensive, it's common to see work done by the dispossessed and the victimized themselves. A cursory search on the internet shows that right now, in fact, refugees on the Burmese border and residents in camps in Darfur are documenting their daily lives with cameras given to them by artists and humanitarian groups. I am not a fan of this kind of work. There is something highly offensive to me about these kinds of images. But I do own one book, which is perhaps the first of this genre, My Auschwitz. It's a facsimile, of course, but still, I've never seen another copy. There's no text, just a statement at the front. It reads, "In 1943, inexpensive Zeissbox Tengor cameras were handed out to a few of the camp's model prisoners." It's no secret that Japan has produced some of the most amazing photo books ever made, and Martin Parr has many, many fine examples in his collection. But I have a few I'm pretty sure would make him jealous. There's not much writing in this one, so I don't know exactly what's going on. It's a book of photos of open caskets in Japanese funeral parlors. The photos all seem to be taken with a cell phone, and in some of the photos, a young Japanese schoolgirl poses with the dead man or woman in the casket, which leads me to imagine that the photographer is herself a schoolgirl. But I have no justification for believing that. Obviously, I'm drawn to photo books about the internet. I've already amassed a huge collection, in fact. Chat roulette may be all the rage now, but the code behind this phenomenon is actually based on a project by Chinese photographer Cheng Li. 2 years ago, Li designed an email that, when opened, would hand over control of the user's webcam. Li's published a few books of stills using these captured cameras. As you can imagine, terrifying, terrifying stuff. So there you have it, dear listener. And while I am thoroughly disappointed I didn't get to share these with Martin Parr in person, I did enjoy showing them to you. And if you'd like to see more, drop me a line. I can show you the whole library. You are always welcome. Oh, wait. You know, there is actually one more book we should talk about. Another recent acquisition. This one is called Trees Hit by Cars, and it's by Adam Frelin.
I would go out for drives, and as I would drive around, I started noticing marks on trees that I had attributed to the fact that something probably hit them at one point in time. And I was going to be driving across the country. And when I knew that I was going to do this, I had a fair amount of time to do the projects that I needed to do. So I decided that it might be interesting if I would continue this project of photographing trees that had been hit by cars. I would talk to people and they would guide me toward one, a tree that had been hit. So for instance, one of the first ones that I photographed, I think I was at a diner and I had said something to the waitress, and the waitress ended up calling over someone who I think was a volunteer firefighter. And he described a location nearby where he knew that there was a tree that had been hit because a tractor trailer truck that had its roof covered with a tarp was sitting out one night, and the water accumulated in it and then froze overnight. And the next day, while it was driving away, someone was following. And as the truck went around a turn, a large hunk of ice came off and ended up smashing through the windshield of the car behind the truck. And it happened to be driven by a 19-year-old woman who, when the ice came through, she veered off the road and ran into the tree and ended up dying from it. I think a lot of people, especially in parts of the country that are very wooded, just have a tendency to sort of like be able to relate to this story. And in my own background, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania on a road that had a very sharp bend and a tree that would continually get hit by cars. It was at about a 90-degree angle. And as the tree continued to get hit, it would become sort of uglier and more grotesque, but at the same point in time, it would become apparently stronger. I had this idea in my mind that the lives of the people that died in hitting this tree were actually absorbed by the tree itself, and which caused it to grow stronger. My father, he would walk around our property with a baseball bat, and when he would find a tree that didn't seem to be doing very well, he would beat it with the baseball bat. And the idea behind this is kind of similar to the idea behind a tree looking as if it's getting stronger after it's been hit. What kind of happens is the tree freaks out and it goes into sort of a mild state of shock. Like anything, if you hit it hard, it'll react. And sometimes that reaction causes growth. But sometimes that growth can also be kind of like a last gasp too, and it can cause the tree to die as well.
Adam, did you ever hit a tree with a car?
Yeah, I did. And actually, there's a photograph. I went back to my hometown and I photographed the tree that I had hit. In my case, it was, you know, it was an unbelievably uneventful story. Snowy night in high school, not even any drinking or anything involved. Going around a bend, just starting to slide, and having enough time while we were sliding to say, we're gonna hit this tree, you know, there's nothing we can do, and just hitting it. And I had the ability to brace myself, like, because we had enough time, and we had probably 5 seconds of being like, oh man, we're gonna hit this tree, because we were only going like 10 or 20 miles an hour, that we had time to brace ourselves. And so you think, I'm ready, this isn't gonna be a problem. And yet, even at that really slow speed, when we hit the tree, you could feel your whole body thrown forward. And nothing I could have done could have stopped that. So there is an amazing experience when you hit something in a car, because knowing that what that feeling is like, I think it's sort of important.
You know, if you just hear the title, Trees Hit by Cars, you can envision many, many things. But, you know, I'm holding the book in my hands, and I have to say that it does look like the trees are winning.
Yeah, they do.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Image Shock. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, Bill Bowen, and Laura Mayer. It featured Paula McCartney, Fred Richin, Robert Voigt, Luke Sant, and Adam Frohlin. Special thanks to Catherine Myers, Paul Amador, and Kara Oler. Visit the TMI show page for links to more images than you can possibly look at, and subscribe to the TMI podcast. You can do all of that at WFMU.org.
Listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and worldwide on the World Wide Web at WFMU.org. Stay tuned for Nardwar, the Human Serviette.
Donies.
And you're listening to WFMU, and it's time right now for the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show. Today on the Nardwar, the Human Serviette Radio Show, an interview with David Spanner, author of Shoot It, Hollywood Inc., and The Rising of Independent Film. David Spanner, today on the Nardwuar, the Human Serviette Radio Show on WFMU. Are you?
David Spanner. I've just written a book called Shoot It about independent film around the world.
And you also wrote a book called Dreaming in the Rain as well.
Yes, which is certainly about Vancouver. Yeah, the book I've written is sort of a critique of the whole Hollywood studio system. And I did interviews with everyone from Mike Lee to Miranda July to filmmakers all over Canada and a lot of the great European filmmakers, the independent people who are rising up kind of in opposition to this whole corporate studio system.
So, David Spanner, you wrote this book, Shoot It, but I want to go back to your other book, Dreaming in the Rain, How Vancouver Became Hollywood North, and then switch a little bit by right off the bat asking you something that I asked you before about how Vancouver and punk rock and Vancouver and hippiedom almost are like number two and three. In other words, number one for punk rock was England, number two was New York, but number three could have been Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And then, to go way back, you said that San Francisco, number one for hippiedom, number two was Vancouver for hippiedom.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably true. You know, I think, I'm not sure with punk rock, you also got Los Angeles in there, which was huge. But, you know, I think the thing is with Vancouver, Vancouver's always been real good at doing subcultures. You know, I mean, it goes back to the 1930s when there was a huge movement here, a political movement during the Depression, and more volunteers left from Vancouver to go to Spain to fight fascism than from any city in North America except New York. And it's continued through the years. There was a beat movement here in the 50s and 60s. And then, of course, in the late 60s, the flowering of the counterculture was huge here, probably maybe the largest anywhere next to San Francisco. And then, of course, in the late 70s, you had the explosion of punk everywhere, and Vancouver had a legendary scene within that movement. The interesting thing with both the counterculture and the punk scenes is that while they're kind of recognized in the international underground, quite often in Vancouver itself, most people don't even know they're going on. But, you know, on top of that, I want to add a third thing, which is the independent film movement here. That started in the 1990s.
Your book is all about,
started in the 1990s. And see, the interesting thing is I was involved in all these things. I was involved in the Yippies, which was, you know, sort of activist part of the counterculture here in the early 1970s. And then later I managed the Subhumans in the punk scene. And then I happened to be fortunate enough to be writing about film in the local daily press when, you know, there was the emergence of a wonderful independent film scene in Vancouver. And it actually started at UBC in the mid-1990s, the West Coast Wave, featuring people like Bruce Sweeney and other Vancouver filmmakers like Lynn Stopkowicz and Mina Shum. And interesting enough, Mina Shum was a punk rocker who had gone as a kid to Subhuman gigs. Lynn had been a punk in Montreal. So there's a real crossover between the independent filmmaking and punk rock. But anyway, the point being, though, is that Vancouver also has had, a great independent film movement, especially in the 90s and early part of the 21st century. So, and the thing that all of these have in common, whether we're talking about the hippie counterculture or punk rock or, you know, the independent film, is they all operate in opposition to the corporate culture. They all realize that corporate culture makes everything dead, that kills everything, makes everything, dumbs down everything. And that, you know, the focus of the book is on film. All over the world, I focus on seven different countries and their film cultures and how they survive when the studio system dominates their screens. How do local film cultures survive? I look at seven different countries, including Canada and the Vancouver scene, but also look at the U.S. and England and Romania and Korea. And the thing that's interesting with all of this is that, you know, these things are not that different in a way. For example, I think the independent filmmakers' relationship to the major studios isn't that different than the independent musicians' relationship to the major labels.
Back to the musicians, though, for punk rock, I kind of said Vancouver was number three, and I kind of put England at number one. Okay, it could be New York at number one, or it could be England at number one. You know, they tie, basically. And then number two for punk, well, let's put Los Angeles and Vancouver together. So it's kind of like two and three.
West Coast.
Because, yeah, it's West Coast sort of thing. But do you believe that, though? Like, the Vancouver, was there really number three, number four?
Well, you know, it's. I mean, it's hard to put a number on it, but I think what's interesting with Vancouver in terms of England is obviously England was number one in the early days of punk. And I think that Vancouver, the Vancouver punk scene was more like the British punk scene than any other North American scene. And what I mean by that is that when punk broke, it was really the huge role models were like, you know, the Sex Pistols and the Clash and the Damned and other British bands. And although the American scenes were heavily influenced, that they, you know, they didn't quite get it the way we did. I mean, we were part of the British Commonwealth. We grew up with the Queen's picture on the wall. We kind of could really, you know, understand that. And the only other Canadian scene that could compete with us on that level was Toronto. But they were so obsessed with being New York that they had no real interest in that, the whole British thing. So because of that, the Vancouver bands and their style, the style of music, even the names they gave themselves, and the look and everything else was more like the original British Sex Pistols Clash scene than any other scene in North America. So I would say that in that sense, in that first wave of punk that was heavily influenced by England, Vancouver might have been, you know, I mean, it was certainly one of the strongest scenes that emerged with bands like the Subhumans and DOA and the Rabid and other bands.
Well, what about the hippies and the yippies and Vancouver being number two after San Francisco? This is something that you told me before, which I was quite surprised by. I didn't realize Vancouver was like number two after San Francisco.
Well, I think the thing is with the hip counterculture, that was hugely, the capital of that was really the West Coast of North America. You know, whereas you could talk about, like with punk, you could talk about New York and England and whatnot. With the hip counterculture, it was clearly the West Coast of North America was the center of it. And